Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching Alive. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und für die heutige Folge spreche ich zu meiner riesigen Freude mit Raphia Morgan. Er ist ein international bekannter und geliebter Therapeut. Gemeinsam mit Turia Hannover hat er den Path of Love gegründet. Und der Path of Love ist ein Retreat, das mein Leben verändert hat. Außerdem hat er mit Osho in Indien und Amerika gelebt und war quasi live bei dem dabei, was ihr vielleicht als Wild Wild Country in der Dokumentation gesehen habt. Ich freue mich wahnsinnig über dieses Gespräch und freue mich, es heute mit euch zu teilen. Viel Freude dabei. Herzlich willkommen dir, ganz, ganz herzlich willkommen dir nochmal hier bei Meditation Coaching and Life. Jedes Mal, wenn ich mit Menschen hier in diesem Podcast spreche, dann sind es Leute, die ich faszinierend finde und deren Arbeit ich bewundere und sehr schätze. Und manchmal ist es aber noch eine extra Portion besonders und ganz großartig für mich. Und die heutige Folge ist so eine Folge. Mein heutiger Gesprächsgast ist Raphia Morgan. Und tja, also wo fange ich da an zu erzählen? Ich habe einige Erfahrungen auf meinem eigenen Weg, man könnte sagen spirituellen Weg oder Coaching-Weg oder Meditationsweg und so weiter gemacht, die einfach unglaublich einschneidend waren und die nachhaltig für immer mein Leben verändert haben. Und Raphia Morgan ist gemeinsam mit seiner quasi Partnerin in Crime, könnte man sagen, Partnerin in Therapy, der ebenfalls ganz wundervollen Turia Hannover, Begründer, die beiden sind die Begründer von einem unglaublich intensiven Programm, das heißt Path of Love. Und so unscheinbar, wie dieser Titel vielleicht erstmal daherkommt, Path of Love, umso krasser hat dieses Programm in sich. Ich verlinke hier in den Shownotes zu Raphia, meinem Gesprächspartner heute, und auch zum Path of Love. Und dann könnt ihr mal schauen, ob ihr damit was anfangen könnt. Und ich kann nur sagen, für mich war es a life-changing experience. Ich hoffe auch sehr, sehr bald hier quasi den zweiten Teil, nämlich das Gespräch mit Turia Hannover, seiner Mitbegründerin von Path of Love, im Podcast hier vorstellen zu können. Hoffentlich ganz, ganz, ganz bald. Aber heute spreche ich erstmal mit Raphia. Raphia ist nicht nur der Begründer von diesem Path of Love, er ist auch ein Therapeut und auch ein Lehrer und auch einer meiner Lehrer. Dieser Path of Love und die Arbeit von Raphia und Turia haben mich so nachhaltig inspiriert und geprägt, dass ich vor einiger Zeit auch begonnen habe, diese Methoden langsam, langsam, Schritt für Schritt zu lernen. Und auch die Ausbildung, in der ich mich gerade noch befinde, ist bei Raphia und bei Turia. Ich spreche also nicht nur mit einer Person, die mich großartig inspiriert, sondern auch mit einem meiner Lehrer auf diesem Weg, was natürlich auch nochmal ein ganz großes Geschenk für mich gewesen ist. Raphia selbst hat ein Leben, und das werdet ihr hier hören, das sich gewaschen hat, könnte man sagen. Ich möchte nicht zu viel vorwegnehmen, aber vielleicht habt ihr ja auch bei Netflix Wild Wild Country gesehen, die Doku über, oder eine Doku über die Kommune von Osho in USA. Und Raphia war einer von den Menschen, die dort gelebt haben. Das heißt, er hat das ganze Ding eins zu eins mitbekommen und er erzählt auch hier darüber. Und er hat nicht nur die Sache mitbekommen, sondern er hat sogar noch einen sehr speziellen Platz in dem Verlauf dieser Sache gehabt. Auch das werdet ihr in dieser Podcast-Folge hören. Er war viele, viele Jahre in Indien, viele Jahre in den USA, lebt mittlerweile in Europa und seine Arbeit und sein Sein und das, was er macht, hat nicht nur mein Leben wirklich geprägt und verändert, sondern ich glaube auch das Leben von vielen, vielen tausend anderen Menschen. Lange Rede, kurzer Sinn. Es ist mir echt eine wahnsinnige Freude. Es war ein lustiges, spannendes Interview und eins, in dem ich teilweise wirklich einfach nur da gesessen habe und gesagt habe, ja, Mann, ja, 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 ja. Es ist mir eine große Freude, dieses Gespräch heute mit euch zu teilen. Ich hoffe, ihr könnt euch inspirieren lassen, ihr könnt euch was davon mitnehmen und ich hoffe, es macht euch ganz viel Mut, darauf auch euren eigenen Weg zu beschreiten und zu gehen und dahin zu gucken, wo, ja, wo es manchmal nicht ganz so hollywoodig und disneylandig ist. Und jetzt muss ich wirklich aufhören, sonst beginne ich Superlative auszupacken und mich zu überschlagen. Deswegen halte ich es kurz und wünsche euch viel Freude mit diesem Gespräch mit dem wirklich großartigen und inspirierenden Raphia Morgan.
All right, thank you very much for your time. I'm super looking forward to this. I don't know where it's going to go, but that's good. But I'd like to start with something. I'd like to like embarrass you right in the beginning.
Okay, that's good.
Nice. Because what I would like to say, and you've heard this a million times, but it doesn't matter to me. Your life's work, literally working with people, developing ways to help people overcome their adversities, to look more deeply inside themselves, to follow their longing, which is something I would like to talk to you about. What you're doing is having an immense impact on people's lives. For me personally, and this is what I wanted to say, when I came to this group that you co-created called The Path of Love, it was, and I don't use these words lightly, but it was a life-shattering and life-changing experience. And it's been something that has been a light on my path ever since I've started working with this work for the last 10, 12 years. It's been one of the big reasons I'm doing what I'm doing. It's been one of the big reasons I'm sitting here. We're doing this podcast. So first of all, from the bottom of my heart, I would like to say thank you and give lots of gratitude. And so here is the first question. I mean, it's a big one, but I mean, what goes into creating something like this, creating such a process? Like, where do you personally come from? What experiences in your life, what realizations have fostered this idea to say, okay, we're going to create something like this. We're going to, you know, help people go through this. We're going to use these tools and so on. Like, how did that happen?
Okay, big question. And if you're talking specifically about Paths of Love, that's one question. But I think I want to back up just a little bit, because basically what happened to me was I was living in Berkeley in California in my 20s, and I went through a big crisis, and I felt about as prepared for life as anybody couldn't be, you know. Even though I had a degree and I'd done all the kinds of stuff, I didn't know what was going on. And so by chance and intelligence and the proximity of, you know, cutting edge work, I ended up in groups. I started going to groups. And that was a lot of the emergent stuff was happening around that time. And I just remember the very first one I went to, which was a men's encounter bioenergetic group. And within about 5 minutes, they were like working on me strongly about my anger and my lack of ability to express it. And they got me into like a deep, deep, full expression. And it was actually exactly the thing that was needed, because I just had no access to it. And consequently, I was in my head and I was all congested emotionally, and that was creating depression. And I was carrying a lot of resentment towards a woman who had betrayed me some months before, and I wasn't able to process it. And I just went fully into that. And then I went into, I was like, wow, these groups are amazing. It's just like, you get there fast. So
did you expect to work with anger, or did you expect to like, I'll go somewhere and I'll feel bliss, they make me feel better?
I had no idea. I really didn't even know what a group was. I just realized I needed some help, and I knew these things were starting to happen around. And by chance I came across this one and it appealed to me, and bam, I can remember walking out of the room like it was yesterday, and it was like, I don't know, 40 years ago or something, and thinking my life just changed, you know, and I was immediately connected to myself in a way that I hadn't been in a long time. And I was out of my head and I was relaxed in my body and I was excited about the way forward and other things that I might do. And I just applied myself to doing groups, and that led to doing a lot of meditation and a whole spiritual journey and, you know, self-healing journey where I did so many different things. And along the way, I realized I had a real natural talent for being able to do it. And the people that were leading things were recognizing me in that way too. And so I was like, oh, I get out of being miserable and maybe I found a profession at the same time. So I started doing some trainings, you know, and I trained in all kinds of different therapeutic modalities. And all of that led me to India, where, because a big part of it was spiritual for me, and I ended up going to see Osho, and I ended up in that commune, and Osho was somebody who brought together Western psychology and groups into an Indian meditation ashram, basically. So there was this mix of both the cutting edge stuff from the West and the ancient traditions of the East mixing there, and you know, it was wonderful. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to me, was being in that commune and being with those people. And he then, after some period of time there, invited me to lead groups in his ashram. And so at a very young age, I started having full groups, not because of me, but because of him. The people were coming and then they were doing the groups. So I got to practice a tremendous amount more than I could have ever generated on my own. And so, and that practice just has gone on and is still going on and has developed. And then I've seen really what really helps me. And I've developed a very good, I think, ability to create processes that affect people on the points that they need affecting on, mm-hmm. and address a lot of, you know, issues that I've addressed inside myself, and then I translate that into a process. So Path of Love came about as a kind of putting together of a lot of that different work, mm-hmm. and also having done a process which used some of the component parts that we have in Path of Love. And then we took a year putting it together and like really working on it every day, because we knew it was like, this is the stuff, man. This is really, because it hit me so deeply, the work that I'd done along that line, and my girlfriend and Taria, and, you know, and so we were meeting every day and working on it, and then it just evolved, and we knew we had this amazing vehicle in our hands, and that was over 25 years ago. And I think that it continues to evolve to this day. And I'm never was, and except that I can't lead it right now because it's very up close and personal, and it's very wet, you could say.
Yeah. Yes.
you know, we can't do it right now, but I'm really looking forward to getting back in there and doing that process, because so many people have come to me, Mike, and they've said just what you said. It was a turning point in my life. It has something in it that brings people to really look for themselves. What is it that they want, and what is it inside of me that's preventing me from realizing my potential? And that's kind of the genius behind the whole thing, is that we're not telling people how to be. They're actually being, we have a structure, but they're being guided by their inner. And, you know, it's like, and that has to do with the longing that you spoke about a little bit ago, you know, like, what do you really want in your life? I mean, like, really want. You know, what is your soul screaming out for? You know, what if that was really possible? And the only thing in the way was just something inside you, and something maybe that happened when you were 6 years old and you're still holding on to it, or whatever. And people just have that arena to work and be very open in presence of other people who are bearing their souls. And then it's just like, as you know, the best in people comes forward in that. And then suddenly you're in this crazy richness. Because once we start cracking open and anything can come out and everything's welcomed, people hit extraordinary depths and drop lifetimes worth of luggage, I think, that they've been toting around with them that's just making life unhappy. So it's a really good process, I can say that.
Yes, it is. One thing that I'd like to ask you about is, now when you say, you know, the longing, right? Wonach sehnst du dich, we would say in German, like das tiefe Verlangen, the tiefe Sehnsucht. Like, there might be a tendency for people just casually listening to like confuse it with, well, what's your big goal in life? Or tell me your vision, like, where do you see yourself 5 years from now, or something like this, right? Something that a lot of like, quote unquote, like coaches and situations like that also work with. It's like, okay, let's sketch out your vision, or let's find your why, and then everything will, you know. And sometimes I think, you know, that's fine, that, you know, on a certain level, that's fine. But there is something else, like there are layers that are a lot more real and a lot more human nature and very personal and so on. So how do people make that transition from like looking at a vision or having an idea or having a plan to actually getting in touch with what's really underneath?
Very good question. And I make that distinction also. There's effective and good work about having goals and what do I want and who do I want to be in 5 years, and, you know, and strategizing how to make that happen. And that kind of falls in the coaching realm. And this one, I think at the core of all spiritual seeking is a kind of ache in the heart that feels and senses that there's something much bigger, much more that I am personally, and it is also in this existence and around me that I'm connected to. And we usually have had moments, whether they're, you know, in meditation or making love or in nature or taking psychedelics or whatever, where people realize that connectedness, and it's like, this is it. I'm home. This is nothing is missing right now. And those moments mark your soul forever. And the heart, I think, always yearns for that space again. And there's a certain, on a spiritual level, there's a certain dissatisfaction, or they call it divine discontent, is another way of understanding the longing. You know, it's like nothing in the world really satisfies. There's something else, and I have this hunger for it. And many people arrive at the group and they don't have a clue about the longing. They don't understand the word, like you're indicating. They haven't really gotten that together. But after a short amount of time in the group and kind of shedding a few layers, you can usually feel in your own heart, you know, what is it that my heart is yearning for? Let's say union with this existence, or for freedom from all the things that keep me bound to this small personality, you know, and the traditional things that always make people move into spiritual paths, really. It's like they want freedom. I want to surrender this ego that's destroying my life. It's causing me so much difficulty, but I don't know how. As you go through this process, this longing starts to, we call it burning, it starts to burn stronger and stronger. And it functions inside, as I understand it, almost like a tuning fork towards the object of what you long for. And so it points you in that direction. I'm longing for freedom. Okay, so it points me towards freedom. I'm longing for union or whatever it is. And then, but it doesn't take you to the object of your longing. It takes you to the barriers that you have inside for which you're solely responsible for keeping yourself separate from the realization of that longing. And so you have to face yourself.
I think that's the point where a lot of people hit the first big problem where they say, oh, this isn't working for me.
Exactly.
Because it's like, well, I'm looking for freedom. I'm looking for relating or a higher form of that. But when I start looking, the first thing I see is I'm not free. I don't have this relationship. I don't experience this love. And oh, it's painful to feel that. So, you know, let's have another beer.
Exactly. And where we get people is we don't serve the next beer.
Whiskey instead.
we keep them in the process. It's 24/7. You get enough sleep, you get enough, you know, food, but there's no diversions on the side. It's like you're in silence when you're not in the group. And so this place is where you never get past maybe a deep identification with being unworthy, for example, which many, many people have. And then you're stuck with it and you grind with it. And then you start, and eventually you start to face it and you start to feel the cage of it and the pain of it and the limited options that are available because you believe that you're unworthy. And at a certain point, then the absurdity of your own unworthiness becomes clear because nobody is unworthy. It's just something that we started believing at a certain age based on experiences we had or based on something somebody told us. And people start peeling the layers and then they come into like this maybe immense self-love and sense of worthiness. I use worthiness as an example right now.
Yeah.
And then they're realizing that what they were longing for, and they realize it was there all the time. Of course, like you always do in all spiritual things, you know, you have to go on a long journey to end up where you started. You always had it, but there were inner barriers preventing you from realizing it. And then in that process, you just keep going right up to the end. And people just get so willing to expose and bring out their dirty laundry and their old beliefs and all of these things which have been just keeping them shrunken and small and compromised and as a victim and disempowered, etc. And so people just start working through stuff until they're like, as you know, like just standing there, just shining in front of everybody. And you get a whole room full of people shining in that space. And nobody ever forgets it. That's one thing I can say about Path of Love. I don't think anybody who does it ever forgets it.
I would imagine, yes. do you think that this state or this realization, that this moment, this shining presence that you just talked about, that people take away from this process. Now, this process is it's a closed container. You know, it's like, it's very structured. There's a, you know, like you said, you take away the distractions from people. You take away the next beer. You take away checking your phone every 5 minutes. You sort of take these things away and you help people to push past the next barrier and not go into the regular habits of escaping and so on. So as a process, this is very powerful. And do you think that this is also possible in, let's say, like a gradual way? Do you think it's possible to do this like two nights a week and then, you know, you do it for...
You're cutting out.
Don't do it. Oh, man. I see and hear you fine.
The last couple of minutes I lost. You were okay. Talking about when people came out and they were shining and then something went wonky with.
Okay. So I'm saying I'm asking it's a path of love, for example, it's a very contained, it's a very tight container. You know, it's like you you take away the next beer, you know, or you take away the checking your phone five times a day and so on and so on. So it's sort of you're putting people in a position where they would usually escape. But it's like, well, this time around, you know, you can't really escape. So you have to stay present. You have to stay there. It's very strong, right? Do you think a similar thing is even possible if you don't do it as a retreat? Like, for example, if you do it like twice a week, like 60 minutes here and then something like that there, like more gradually, do you think that's also possible? Or do you think we need these condensed containers in order to sort of advance?
It depends on the person. I think some people have such an inner desire to realize who they are that they self-regulate that and they don't compromise it and they keep themselves in the fire on their own and they move. But in general, we're kind of herd creatures and we want to go the path of least resistance. And so we need a strong container also, and the next beer is just right next to you, you know, so it's very easy to not do that work. And it's even easy for people when they come out of the path of love to go back into their old patterns, you know, and this is something that we're forever working on, because peak experiences are peak experiences. And then you come back into your home environment where you have a lot of contracts and agreements to be the person you were before. And you have a lot of obligations and responsibilities and everything. And you go, you don't keep that super high space. You remember it and you find ways to cultivate that, and you might come back and be on the staff of the Path of Love. Some people have done it 30, 40 times, been on the staff, because they just love to be in that space and they want that remembrance inside. Or you develop a practice that keeps it cultivating, and we're forever working on follow-up processes that are based on similar similar language with similar intentions, so that people, would it be so easy as to just have a total quick fix? But if you have a really strong experience, like you talked about at the beginning, you don't forget it. And you see that you made some different moves in your life. You were at a crossroads. You chose something different after that, and was based on that experience. And you can look back retrospectively and say, you know what? After I did that, my life changed. Yes. I started doing different things. And that those things had consequence to where I am right now. So the answer to your question is, yes, of course, people can realize their deepest potential without doing the Path of Love. And the Path of Love is a tremendous accelerator, you know. And when it comes down to it, it's wonderfully fun also, even if you go through a bit of hell.
I can attest to both of those. I can attest to the hell and the fun, you know?
Yeah.
I've described it to some friends. It's like, well, you're walking along this path and then it's sort of like, there comes a Ferrari. You sort of get into this car, you go racing, you know, you speed down you're on this incredible journey. And then you get out the car and things are different. You've seen different things, but you have to sort of keep walking or drive your old Ford Fiesta or something, you know, ride a bike or something, you know, along that way. And I think it's a beautiful accelerator. And you've used that word as well. Yeah. And I wonder if, you know, if we backtrack a little bit, you know, do you think it seems to me like you got lucky, you know, your first experience of going into a group, not knowing what to expect, like you get this acceleration, like right in the beginning and you know, okay, this is it. Boom. You know, what did you do next from there? Did you develop a steady practice? How did your journey on this path begin?
I think that even in my childhood, I was having moments where there was some feeling for something spiritual, and I never understood them. And I remember trying to explain things to my parents once when I was young, of things I was experiencing, and they were looking at me really weird. And so I learned what was not really acceptable. And so then it became a kind of hidden secret in me. And then I was using psychedelics for a while at that time in my life, and that really changed my life also. It just opened something up where I was like, wow, this is it. I experienced a part of myself that was just completely free, and that was universal, and that had no fear and no tension. And that also marked me in a way. And then, you know, that's a peaky experience. Mm-hmm. That then I start looking for ways to try to get back to that. And of course, I was hopelessly lost for a long time. And then the first thing then was doing this one group, even though there was a spiritual penchant, you can say, underlying everything. It wasn't just therapy that I was after, but I started seeing the relationship to therapy and to opening up my body and to opening up my emotions and to bringing things out that I was ashamed of and showing them was bringing me greater feeling of freedom and happiness in my life. That was happening in the therapy aspect. And in the other aspect, I was also meditating. I was also going and visiting different teachers that were around it, particularly in that area, was a real gold mine of people coming, and I was reading books. And
can you say some people that you studied with at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I was into a guy named Trungpa Rinpoche, who,
yeah, sure,
you know, Crazy Wisdom. I belonged to a Gurdjieff group, mm-hmm, of some really old disciples of him. They somehow I got invited to be part of. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in Vipassana. I got together with a Thai monk at one point named Dhiravamsa, who was really interested in bioenergetics and sitting. Mm-hmm. You know, and this guy is a real traditional, you know, Buddhist monk. And yet he got into us doing these high stress postures of bioenergetics and having these releases and then sitting, you mm-hmm know, and we would sit for hours and hours, you know. And God, I mean, everybody came through, but those are the ones that come to mind right now that really touched me. And I was not so much into the transcendentalists, because I also had this passion and love for life. And I was always with this question, like, you know, I love this life. I want to be in it, you know? And that's when I came to Osho. And Osho's basic thing was Zorba the Buddha, mm-hmm, you know, the passion and the involvement in the marketplace with the people. And at the same time, not of it, keeping that awareness so that you're, you know, you have this focus that takes you through and you can navigate in it. And that really spoke to me, because I had also been a political activist before, mm-hmm, that, when I was in Berkeley, and I couldn't just turn my back on all the stuff that was happening in the world. And a lot of times I felt like that was the whole transcendental approach was just, I don't know, it was a little too privileged and a little bit too rejecting on some level of what else was going on. And I felt, as soon as I started reading Osho, I started going, oh, he gets the whole picture, you know. And it included sex, and it included feelings, and it included, you know, Western philosophy and psychology and the mysteries of the Eastern, you know, religious practices. And he was attracting the most fun and alive and wild and crazy people of the time, I think. And so finally, when I realized I could actually go and see him, I was 10 feet inside the ashram, and I was looking around and I was going, my God, I hit the jackpot of the planet.
So you were like, at some point in Berkeley, you're deciding, I'm going to go to India. I'm going to go there. I'm going to meet this guy.
Yeah. I mean, Berkeley was the center for America for a long time. It was like where the cutting edge of everything was happening. And I started feeling like it's just not the same anymore. And then I got into this, and then the spiritual work got deeper and deeper. And then all of a sudden I realized, wow, I could go and see this guy in India. And then I was like, really? Oh, and then I was like, yeah, I think I should do that. Who knows how long he's going to be around? And then I walked in there and I felt like, wow, I've just moved from the former greatest event that was happening in the world to the real greatest event that's happening. That was my perception. And I felt so grateful and so lucky. And I feel like in one way I've been under a lucky star in my life in that way, or I've had something, my own longing, guiding me inside that's taken me to all of these different places and where I've received all these teachings and had chances to practice and be with wonderful people, you know. And so, hello. I feel pretty lucky, actually. And I think I made some intelligent choices. You know,
I wonder what it was like when you walked into that ashram and you were like, this is the best thing in the world. Like, what can you set the scene for me? Like, can you describe to me? I mean, I've been there now recently, you know, it must be, I mean, no comparison at all. You know, what was that like to like go there and feel it? And what was the scene?
I mean, I walked at the front gate and the first people that met me later became really good friends of mine. They were two just absolutely amazingly gorgeous and fun women. And within seconds,
I had a feeling.
I'm sure it wasn't stupid. No, but they were just so alive and they were so much fun just to talk to on arrival. And there was thousands of people there. I mean, it was really the thing that was happening on the planet. And it was in India. And at that point, India was still like, I don't know, it was like 100 years ago in a way. In India, it was a different world. And we were allowed to live and be there in a way that was very free. And then Osho would come out every day and talk, and I would be just blown out, just sitting there sometimes for a couple of hours afterwards, like, what was that? You know, just amazingly deep. And then the groups, and then the fun, you know, it was always around Osho, it was always a lot of fun too. Not always, I mean, he was heavy duty, but he also had an incredible sense of humor and he loved absurdity, you know, and it's like absurdity is a transcendental moment, you know, and it's just like, it's just off the rails.
So,
what was your question? I'm just talking about the path that I got on, and
that's fantastic, because especially also this I'm fascinated, I'm super interested in the times in India, also in the States later with Osho, because I mean you know, we know it from some documentaries, you know, there's some TV documentaries, and then there's some, I remember there was a big scare going on in the 80s. It's like, oh my God, the guru is coming, and the people from the cult, and you know, especially in Germany, you know, people are very afraid, like, you know.
Damn.
You know, so it's like, so that's why I'm so interested in always hearing, because from all the people that I speak to that were there at the time, it's not like people are not like, oh, we were, you know, going to take over the world. But it's a very different experience for people, you know.
Yeah.
So that's super interesting.
Yeah. There were a lot of Germans there.
Yes. Very true.
A lot of Germans, the Germans really came. And so a lot of crazy press came out also in Germany.
I think the Germans, you know, after the Second World War, this is just my weird theory. It's a lot of repression in Germany, you know, a lot of pushing away of things, a lot of not trying to look at things. And then this is just my fantasy, but then you have this place where it's like, no, it's fine to bring the guilt and the shame and to look at it and to work through it and to grow from it and so on. It must have been for everyone, it must have felt like a tremendous kind of relief, you know?
Well, it was, I think, for everyone, no matter what your conditioning was. But I remember Germans of my age who were born post-war were carrying a tremendous guilt and shame, and they worked it out in the groups and stuff. And I felt, you know, I have so many Germans that I'm close to, and I felt like they really unlocked themselves from carrying that burden, you know, that was so strong culturally. And so then they were really shining in their magnificence and in their beauty, rather than, you know, in apology and shame and their creativity, because I think a lot of creativity got cut off in that in that shame also. So I don't know if that's why so many Germans came. Germans, I think, also as a culture are very intelligent, and there was just something that happened in Germany that brought so many people. I know in Cologne, around Friesenplatz, in the middle of Cologne, it was like you couldn't walk 5 feet without seeing somebody in orange clothes.
Yeah, some friends that were, you know, kids back then, you know, growing up with all these people around, or even kids of sannyasins, you know.
Yeah.
Did you actually go with Osho back to America as well?
Yeah.
The famous wild, wild country situation.
Yeah, I was. The funny thing is, I have to say, is I only watched 2 episodes of the Wild, Wild Country, because even though there were some ways where I could appreciate what they were trying to do, and the man who was representing the sannyasins was a friend of mine, and I felt he did a reasonable job. It was so different from my experience, and I didn't get the feeling that why we were all there was really addressed. You know, it was just dealing with a lot of things on the surface, and for sure, a lot of weird stuff happened there. But in another way, it was really one of the best times I ever had in my life. I mean, it was so amazing what we did there. We created a city in like 5 years out in the middle of, you know, the Oregon desert, basically. And we had so much fun doing it. You know, it was out there. And here we are in India, you know, on this kind of like guru thing, and everybody's got kind of long stringy hair and looks like an old hippie in India, and wearing what we call lungis, or you just wrap around you, and you know, and then 3 months later, the same guy's driving a D8 Caterpillar bulldozer or something, and we're building a dam, you know, and wearing cowboy boots and chewing tobacco or something, you know. And that was just all part of this amazing show that Osho was able to orchestrate and bring together, and that everybody was really happily, not everybody, but pretty much everybody was joyously participating in. I was having a great time, you know, on the ranch. And it turned out that my girlfriend happened to be the woman who took care of Osho. So I got a real front row seat to the whole thing that was going on. And so my experience is quite different in some ways. And when Osho left the country, I was on the plane with him that left. So I didn't stay behind and have to pick up a lot of the pieces that a lot of my friends did and stuff, or even face that. For me, it just, the show continued. We went on a 9-month world tour around the, trying to find a country for him to live in. Yeah. And we were rejected everywhere until we went back to India. So I had a very unusual experience at that point, but the time in Oregon was fantastic. You know, even there was a lot of weird stuff, and the whole Sheila story is for real, and Sheila was crazy, yeah, in my opinion, and she was empowered in some way by Osho, and I still don't really understand that, but the overall experience, I felt like we went from India to the belly of the beast, which was America, and we built this city, and he was in, you know, within 5 years, everybody in the country knew who he was. And it didn't work out totally in that everybody didn't wake up, but he put a pretty big challenge out there. And then the whole thing with the cars, I want to say one thing, you know, yeah. America's worship materialism. And what is the symbol of materialism in America but the car? And what's the ultimate car, at least in those days, for it's a Rolls Royce. And so there was a lot of very wealthy people that came around Osho. And the thing just turned out to be, buy him a Rolls Royce. And he had them painted with peacocks all over them and rainbows and stuff like that. I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of them. He didn't give a rat's ass about the Rolls Royces. It was just more of the fun, and it was a gimmick, you know, to catch the attention of everybody. And there was that kind of money floating around too. I think he had 95 of them or something. Wow. He didn't own one of them. They were just owned by the organization, you know.
Yeah. What happened to all the Rolls Royces when Osho left and got sent back to India?
They went up for auction. Because there was a lot of debts and stuff, and
so there are actually people now that own the Osho Rolls Royces.
That's
crazy.
And some of them have kept them. I mean, if you remind me, I can send you some pictures of some of the paint jobs that were on some of them. Unbelievable. And it just added to the completely off the charts celebration, let's say, that was going on, was Osho driving around. And anyway, that's just another one of the stories that I don't think has ever been properly understood.
Mm. Sure. I mean, it's a complex thing, especially if you're just looking from the outside onto it. You know, how would you get the whole scope? And one thing that I find very interesting, as we're talking about this situation, right? Some people might say, oh, that's like just pure guru worship, and you're taking away people's, you know, people work for free and so on and so on and so on. But then another side is that people don't talk about is what you mentioned in the beginning. You said, well, I went there and Osho empowered me to lead groups, and Osho invited the Western psychology and different approaches and told people, well, experiment with this, empower. So it actually feels like in that situation, a lot of people were empowered to create their own ways, to create their own path, to try out their own things, to lead their own groups, to do their own thing. It doesn't, you know, and now even if you look at that, you know, so many different processes and groups and meditations and all of stuff come out of that. So it seems like there's also a lot of like, well, do your thing, empower yourself kind of going on, you know?
It's totally true what you're saying. I mean, of course, there was a following of him. He was the reason the whole thing existed, and he was transmitting the most incredible wisdom and humor and everything to us all the time. But what was really celebrated also was the individual. And, you know, you're not just part of an army, you know, you're here to find out who you really are and to individuate all the way out of all the cultural biases, the conditioning from your childhood, the beliefs that you have, and find out really who you are and stand in that and shine. And that was a big part of his message. And then the work that we all did was just to make a beautiful, functioning community with thousands of people in it work. And it was really, by and large, the work was fun. You know, it was fun. We're with a bunch of other people building a hotel or grading a road or growing crops, or, I mean, we really did it. So it probably looks like a lot of like blind following, but I really want to say that the individual and the blossoming of the individual, and he was so big on that one. And he was such an example of an individual.
Oh, yeah. That, never having met him, you know, but that's very true. And also the humor, you know, that's one thing that it's just fascinating to me, the humor and the lightness. And when Osho left his body, how did you continue your path there? Like, were you already on your way to, let's say, like, having your own groups, creating your own way, sort of doing that? Like, was it like a, I know you also after that, I'd like to speak about that if you like, you began also studying with some other teachers as well, also going very much in depth into the diamond approach, for example, yeah. You know? Yeah. What happened then? Like, how did that path develop after that, after sort of the closeness to Osho wasn't there anymore?
Well,
the physical.
Yeah. I was already leaving at some point to go to Europe, primarily Germany, to the center in Cologne, to run some groups every once in a while and then come back. I needed not much money to live in India, but I needed a little bit. And so I would go out, and I had enough of a reputation at that point that things booked for me pretty well. And then when he left his body, the very first thought that came in my mind was, oh, it's as masterful as everything else he's done. It's time for him to go. Otherwise, we would cling to his robes forever. And it's time to take everything that I've learned and gotten and take it out into the world. And I remember that it was almost like a voice inside of me saying that, and still I hung out there for 5 more years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I started traveling more and more, but it was just such an attachment with all my friends, the beauty of being in India. And it was fun, you know, it was like we kind of celebrated for about 5 years. After you know, and then I... during that time, you mentioned the diamond work. I read a book from Almas, Hamid Ali Almas, and it answered so many questions for me of things that I was up against in working with people that I wrote a letter to him. And funny, I just found this letter like 2 days ago going through some old stuff, and he wrote back. And I asked I said, look, I can get a group of about 30 really experienced therapists together. Would you come and lead a group for us? You know?
Yeah.
And he wrote back and he said, well, my work tends towards the long term. I didn't know at that point that, you know, it takes like 35 years or something to digest his work. But he was very sweet in the letter. And like I said, I just read it the other day. And so I was like, well, okay. And then I went to San Francisco that summer and I ended up getting introduced to the man who co-created that work, a man named Faisal Mukaddam. And I had a couple of sessions with him and I was just blown out. And so we put together a group in Italy of those same therapists, basically, that we'd offered out to Almas, and Faisal came over and introduced us to some of that work that you experienced in working with people. Mm-hmm. And it just blew our minds. And he made four of us like teachers after like 5 days or something. We didn't know it for shit. No, we really didn't. But he just said, it's okay. You just study it and study it and study it and practice it and keep reading. He said, if you have to sit there and read from your notes, read from your notes. Mm. And we were at first. We're going, and then the in the red, you know, or whatever. And then we learned it and stayed with Faisal for, I don't know, 8 to 10 years or so, like doing regular retreats. And it was a huge integration for me of bringing Western psychology and Eastern, Middle Eastern mysticism together in the way that they had discovered it through their own inquiry, really, also from Berkeley.
When you say the word inquiry, that's it's a buzzword, right?
Yeah.
Inquiry and the way Almaz and Faisal in this diamond work, the way they use it, you know, it's very unique. It's very specific. Could you speak a little bit about what that means and how it applies to your inner search, let's say?
I can. To really understand it takes a little while, but I just introduced the word inquiry. And it's it literally means to question, to inquire, and to question implicit with to question means I don't know. Wouldn't question otherwise. So then if you're going forward with inquiry, it means that you want to know. So your inquiry is to try to discover. I'm going to inquire into something to try and discover the truth of that thing. And what I'm inquiring into in the diamond work is myself and the things that come up in me. And so there's this atmosphere of curiosity about my own experience that I can forever inquire into. And in order to do that, another element, there's, I'd say, five major elements. Another element of that is courage. It takes courage to go in and to really look at and to really question yourself and to face whatever you find inside, you know? And then it takes the love of the truth, you know? And it takes a lot of compassion for yourself and the way you were conditioned, you know, by culturally and in your family. And then it requires perseverance. You know, the what we call the white, staying with it, you know, and I think it's a really amazing tool for self-discovery. You know, there was the spiritual tools of devotion and prayer and surrender and spiritual tools of meditation, awareness, consciousness, and that. And there's inquiry. It's a third path, I think, and I didn't know about it before. And it's like, I think you, so it's, and it's very, something I do even today, I did an inquiry, you know, it's like just so interesting to use inquiry for self-discovery. And it's not telling stories. It's a method that's very active in the moment and it takes a little while. So I say this for to you and to your audience, if you come across the possibility to learn inquiry as another method of self-discovery that you can do almost anywhere on your own or with partners or in groups and stuff, find out about it because it's immensely helpful. And it's another huge accelerator for me in terms of seeing the territory between my separate ego structure, personality, and my being or my essence or my true self, you could say. And inquiry can really take you to that. And and you really have to uncover all the stones along the way and look and stay with it and stay curious and love the truth and be courageous. And it will reveal, you know, who we are, on the other side of our personality. And I think it's important for me to say I'm not anti-personality. I'm very compassionate with personality. And I see it as an intelligent strategy to survive in the environment you grew up in.
Yeah, well, that's a sentence that resonates so deeply with me. You know, it's let me say it like this. It's I think a lot of times, you know, when I look at myself, I find so many things that I wish weren't there. You know, so many habits, so many thought patterns, so many behavioral patterns where I'm like, you know, if I could be free of this, or like, and why am I like that, and so on. You know, so. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, you can have this approach to say, well, that's wrong, you know, that I'm like, that I think this, that I act this way, that I believe this, that's wrong. I want to get rid of it, right? And to me, it has always seemed like that path is a bit dangerous, because then every time I don't get rid of it, I'm a bad guy again. Like, you know, every time it comes up again, like I failed. And also, it's like I'm trying to hack away at a part of myself, you know what I mean? Exactly. And to have this sentence to say, well, you know, your personality or your strategies, they're a sort of an intelligent expression of trying to deal with the world, you know, at a certain point in time. It might have been valid 20 years ago when you were a child, you know, and you still carry that with you. It might not be that valid today. So you might be able to, you know, compassionately look at it, change it, and so on. It's been a big game changer for me, because it helps me to not make myself bad and wrong for things that, you know, I don't necessarily like about myself. But it's like, well, all right, what's the good in there, and what was it good for, and how can I look at it differently? You know,
exactly, very well said, and it's true. And the other thing about it is, it doesn't work trying to get rid of it. You know, it just doesn't, you know, it comes back and it haunts you. You can repress it. You can try, you know, to overcome it, but it doesn't really. And I think what dissolves it is compassionate, loving understanding that you developed a particular trait or way of behavior out of a strategy or an attempt to survive the environment you grew up in, and to get some love out of that environment, and to avoid, you know, rejection and punishment. And then we get fixed into that, we fixate into that personality, and so it's limiting to us, but it doesn't help if we hate it or we go against it. We have to understand it. We have to compassionately see, wow, I became that way because I was so scared as a kid, you know, and then we stay with it a little bit, and then something starts to transform in it. Then we start to surround it with awareness, that pattern, so that when it comes up, our awareness is around it and we start to have choice. You know, we can say, okay, you know what? I really come to understand why I behave that way, and actually doesn't really serve me to just go ahead with that right now. And I just, what was it I discovered in my inquiry? Oh yeah, right. Let me try that. And slowly we metabolize the rigidity and the fixedness of the personality. And what I believe is our essence or our true nature starts to be able to shine through again. And it's a slow process, but it's a good process. And I take the attitude, may it never end.
Yeah, it's a really different approach to saying, okay, I identify what my problem is and I will cut it off from now on. Or I will be super disciplined and you know, suppress that, and that's the way to, you know, to, which is something that is propagated a lot nowadays. You know, it's like, well, we identify the non-virtue and then we hammer it, we cut it off, we exercise it, we you know, and it feels like we're hurting ourselves by doing that.
Because by being against it in that way, and trying to eradicate is a form of hatred. And we're hammering some hatred against ourselves, and that is going to play out most likely negatively. So I really think, you know, compassion is not licensed to just do whatever you want. It's like, oh, you know, I had a tough childhood, so I can, and I'm compassionate about it, so I can do whatever I want. It's not that, yeah. But it's like, you know, compassion that I am that way, then I can cut into the wound even deeper. I want to find out really what did happen to me in there that made me, say, so jealous, or made me so cruel at times. Why did I develop that way? And I tell you, the inquiry works. It will slowly unpack the history and the beliefs and all of that until you can really see it. You can almost like hold it in your hands and say, okay, you served me really well. Thank you. We survived. I survived. But I don't need to behave that way. I'm not going to anymore. I wouldn't choose that behavior anymore. I've come to a place where something else has displaced it. And I've had that experience so many times that I know it's true. You know, and so that, and that's where I have problems sometimes with coaching, sometimes with NLP, sometimes with some of these things that have a real strategy to try and change you or get you someplace. And I see that it has an important place to play, mm-hmm. you know, and I know lots of people who are coaches and I get coaching, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. but as a real life transformative thing, I don't think that's transformational. It might help me to understand myself a little bit better and to figure out a strategy so that I can get where I think I want to go. But sure. I'm more in that place where I'd rather life unfolds as it needs to and wants to, and I respond to it rather than, you know, my will be done.
I'd like to touch on I'd like to touch on 25 things before we go, but I know, I appreciate you're taking time. I'm just curious to sort of pick your brain about this, you know, for a moment. I think as we are trying to identify within ourselves what's wrong and then maybe try to turn it off and try to cut it off, it seems to me like we have a very strong tendency to do that to each other, to sort of have some sort of system of determining what is correct, what is incorrect, and then sort of dishing out the hatred or the control or the, not only to ourselves, but also towards each other, which I think in some way we need to do it because we have to live together. We have to find some sort of rules or something like that. But, well, I don't know where I'm getting at really, but okay, let's maybe put it in the context of social change, you know, like how, let me ask the question this way. How much do you think inner work is necessary to facilitate real outer work? Or would you say, well, those are two different things. They can happen apart from each other and it's great if you do both, but one doesn't necessarily have to do with the other, you know? As I'm experiencing, I'm asking because this topic comes up again and again in conversations that I have, you know? People might say, oh, I'm only doing inner work, you know, the outer world I'm not interested in. Other people might say, I need to change the world around me. And as long as there's injustice in the world, I have no right to look at myself or work with myself because that would be selfish, you know? And those are the two extremes, you know, and then there's many opinions in the middle. So I wonder where you would stand out of your experience, because you have this experience in the spiritual path, but you also have this experience in social activism, and you have the experience of speaking with thousands of people. And I'm sure that this comes up again and again. So I wonder where do you stand, and is there something that you could maybe give as a hint or give as an advice for people facing this situation?
Well, I can talk about my own experience and then I can talk about I can talk about how people might orient themselves in relation to your question. But, and I hope it's okay to talk about this on your show, but my very first LSD experience.
Absolutely, we can even say fuck, shit, everything. We can talk about drugs, it's fine.
What came, and I was at that point, I was pretty much involved in the kind of revolution that was happening in Berkeley and changing the world and feeling very, very righteous about it and very clear and being very against all kinds of things and fighting in the streets and getting gassed by the police and, you know, and having a good time with it, but also feeling very righteous about it. And there was about 50,000 people in Berkeley who were of the same mind, so there was an incredible illusion of power in that moment also. Mm. And yet we did do a lot. My generation did a lot. We stopped the war. Yes. We brought in, yes, you know, like civil rights came in, and there, yes, was very, very important stuff that came out of that. So I don't want to put it down, but on that trip that I took, which changed my direction, was a very clear realization that what needed to change was me. And the world would change. And then there's that great quote from Mahatma Gandhi, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. And I didn't know that quote at that point, but I did see, I suddenly had this vision of myself and my friends as these kind of very guilty white middle-class guys who were, in a way, doing the latest sport, mm-hmm, in a certain way, which was called fighting the police and, mm-hmm, and doing all this. And, but very good, you know, we grew up in the 50s, my generation, you know, and that was really straight land. And we were needing to crawl out of that conditioning. And the world was really in a mess at that point. And the Vietnam War was happening. And, you know, women's liberation was just starting. And civil rights for Black people was big in those days. And the Black Panthers were all over the place. And I was involved with all of that stuff. But I realized really deeply that something needed to change inside of me before I was going to really become an effective agent for change that was going to translate out on the outer world. And of course, that selfish question came up with friends of mine who took the very hardcore political thing, like, I don't have the right, you don't have the right, what are you doing, looking at your navel, stuff needs to happen and stuff. And I could see that, well, I'm just an angry, guilty, white middle-class guy out there banging around about things. And yeah, that's good and it has a place and I'll continue to do it. But where the real transformation needs to happen first is inside of me. And that really was a big part of setting me further on the path and really going for this inner transformation. And now I feel like I do have something to say about things. I still react to stuff in the world. I still have my opinions about things, but I have a different point of reference inside of myself. So I don't think it's wrong. I think it's very right to have to stand up for a lot of the political issues that are really coming out and relevant right now. And I think if real transformation is going to happen on this planet before we destroy the planet,
yeah,
a lot of inner work needs to happen. A lot of waking up needs to happen, you know, because that whole victim perpetrator cycle that we get into, you know, it's like on one hand victims, on the other hand, we want justice and we want revenge and we're even cruel in that revenge sometimes. I had it coming, you know. So what's curious to look at? Oh, the cruelty inside, you know. Mm-hmm. That becomes interesting. What about my cruelty? What about my righteousness? You know, I feel like I need to look at those things all the time. And so I go. But I think that the outer world, of course, very important. Just like Osho's thing, Zorba the Buddha, you know, we've got to be fully in the world and at the same time develop an awareness and a consciousness inside that's clear and that's clean and that knows yourself and that you're not part of the problem and you're not abusing other people or the environment or the world. And that's a challenge. You know, it's a challenge for me still today, you know, and right now it's particularly poignant because of what's happening in the world, you know. Mm. I don't know if we're going back to how it was before. Mm. I mean, really, this is, who knows?
Maybe that's not even a perfect place to go back to, you know. Maybe there's, if we do it right, maybe there's some opportunity, you know?
Yeah, if we do it right. Otherwise, you know, we kind of screwed things up here. I read this amazing thing the other day. If you took the whole history of this planet and reduced it into 24 hours, human beings have been around for the last 4 seconds. Planet was doing fine before us. are we really needed? We've made quite a mess of it.
Yeah, but while we're here, we, you know, might as well aspire to make something out of it.
Yeah, the best and the highest. And we know that we put our heart and our soul into it. Yeah, on a personal level, inside and outside, both. And I think when we really do the inner work inside, it happens more easily and it's informed from a different place on the outside and will be more effective.
Thank you very much,
Mike.
it's been a pleasure. It's been inspiring. And a lot of the things you said, especially when you described the inquiry, the path of love, I mean, it's like, I'm listening, but at the same time, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. And I hope that some of that, you know, can transpire to the people listening. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And as always, it's really a pleasure to be around you. I've appreciated you and your participation in the work. And I fully support you in doing what you're doing right here. And I hope you get an ever larger audience because, no, really, I feel you're really coming from a good space, Mike. And so much love to you, brother.
Thank you, man. Appreciate that.
Wenn dich die Themen aus diesem Podcast interessieren und du dich darüber austauschen möchtest, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in unsere Facebook-Gruppe zu kommen. Du findest sie bei Facebook unter 4O plus X, das ist viermal der Buchstabe O und dann plus X, oder unter dem Namen Stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Zum weiteren Vertiefen der Themen lade ich dich auch herzlich dazu ein, mein Buch zu lesen oder zu hören. Es heißt auch Stell dir vor, du wachst auf und 4O plus X ist die Methode für mehr Achtsamkeit und Klarheit im Alltag, die ich darin beschreibe. Du findest das Buch überall, wo es Bücher gibt, sowohl als Hörbuch als auch als Paperback. Wenn du mit mir in Verbindung bleiben möchtest, dann besuch mich auf Instagram unter CursedZeit, auf Facebook unter CurseOfficial oder schreib gerne eine Mail an coaching@curse.de. Bis zum nächsten Mal, nur das Allerbeste. Yes.